Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon. My name is John Kelly, bar number 21913. I'm the attorney for the appellant, Sunshine Gardens LLC, in this case. If it pleases the court, the issue that is presented here has to do with under the extent to which a certificate of review under the statute is required when the thrust of the complaint has to do and sounds in contract. Definitive case, the statute, of course, requires a certificate of review for cases that sound in negligence. And in those cases, cases that sound in negligence that are complex enough that require expert testimony to make a decision. For example, divisions of this court have decided in cases that sound in negligence do not require a certificate of review, where, for example, a realtor is accused of withholding information that knowingly withholding information from a person to whom he or she owes a duty to disclose information.
Mr. Kelly, just to kind of get the framework correct, am I accurate that you are not appealing the court's order that your negligence claim was properly dismissed because there wasn't a certificate of review?
That is correct. The only thing that we're concerned about on appeal is the survival of the breach of contract claim.
Thank you.
In the case of Baumgarten and Martinez, 842 Pacific 2nd, 245, the court there attempted to define, and this has been reviewed by divisions of this court since, that negligence claims are based on the premise that the person or entities have certain legislatively or judicially recognized duties toward others and are required to reasonably fulfill such duties. And then from there get into the issue of whether or not testimony is required. There seems to be sort of a hole out there in the case law. With the facts of this case, when we look at the complaint in this case, the general allegations of the complaint are all geared to setting up the plaintiff's claim for breach of contract. Then there's the first claim for relief for breach of contract. The complaint talks about specific clauses in the party's letter agreement. For example, in the record on pages 45 to 49 is the party's letter agreement. That states, we, the defendants, are pleased to inform the undersigned, who it turned out to be the appellants or plaintiffs here, that they have agreed to provide auditing services for this HUD audit in order to provide an annual report to maintain the HUD financing for this project. That letter agreement specifically provides that we expect to begin preliminary audit work prior to the end of the year, to continue in February, and to issue our report no later than March 31st, 2008. When the court looks at the letters that led up to that, for example, on page 26 of the record, it's clear that the defendant, the appellee in this case, was aware of this deadline. In fact, had helped the appellant meet that deadline a numerous years previous to that.
Doesn't the agreement, though, also say that if for any reason that the defendants are unable to complete the audit or can't have formed an opinion or can't give a unqualified opinion, they can decline to express an opinion or issue the report?
I'm glad that you brought that up. My argument about that would be it's a contract defense.
Say what?
A contract defense. If the the zinc firm believes that they had were relieved of their contractual obligation to perform this audit, And under the contract, they also agreed to propagate the HUD templates in time to submit the audit to HUD. When you look at the arguments that counsel on the other side has made, they would seem to indicate that actions of the plaintiff in this case have made it impossible to perform. And that's certainly an argument that they could bring up if we ever got down to the merits of the case. But the issue here is whether or not this sounds in contract or sounds in tort.
Well, let me ask you another question about that. I think what you're stating is that the issue that the defendants are raising are an affirmative defense as opposed to your prima facie case.
To the extent that those issues that they've raised are defenses to a breach of contract case, yes, I believe that those would be an affirmative defense to a breach of contract case.
Why would it be an affirmative defense as opposed to just trying to negate your obligation of proving a breach?
I agree with you. Some of those defenses would just be standard defenses. Some of those may be affirmative defenses. And I'd have to go through and figure that out one by one. Of course, the defendants here have not actually filed an answer, so it's kind of difficult to discern. You know, they haven't answered the breach of contract complaint. So
here's what I'm trying to grapple with. The agreement, as I understand it, seems to say, okay, we're going to agree. We, the accounting firm, are going to agree. We're going to do this audit, do it by March 31st. But we may not be able to, and for whatever reason, if we can't, we're not going to do it. And some of those reasons are they also agree that they're going to perform all of their services in accordance with all of these rules and regulations of HUD and of the accounting profession, all of which are set out in the agreement itself. And the reason I asked about the negligence claim is because presumably the trial court said, well, you didn't file, you have this negligence claim. You can't prove that there's negligence without showing that the defendant somehow didn't follow through with those duties. And that's you use exactly the same language in your contract claim. So I'm trying to understand how the trial court erred in saying, well, it's one and the same. It's the same actions you're complaining about, whether you call it contract or negligence.
Yeah. And my response to that, Your Honor, is that in the complaint itself, the general allegations identified these specific provisions of the contract. And the general allegation said these specific provisions of the contract, providing the audit by a date certain and so on, those were breached. The fact that there may also have been a negligence claim out there as well doesn't detract that the main thrust of the complaint, the negligence claim is sort of an afterthought on that.
How would you know that by reading the complaint? Are you relying on the mere fact that it was the second claim for relief rather than the first claim for relief?
Your Honor, I would argue that you would know that from reading the general allegations in the complaint. The general allegations identify the parties, identify the terms of the contract, identify how those terms were breached, identify that damages were suffered as a result, and that those damages were foreseeable damages as a result of the breach of contract. That, in essence, are the first 15 or 16 paragraphs of the complaint. Nothing in those first 15, 16 paragraphs say that defendants owed plaintiffs a duty.
Excuse me, counsel. Your complaint, though, does refer to the written contract, which December 14, 2007 mm-hmm. engagement letter, right?
Correct.
So that contract is under Colorado law is made a part of the pleadings, and it needs to be looked at in determining what the complaint is pleading, right?
I would agree with that. Yes.
And the agreement says our audit will be conducted in accordance with U.S. generally accepted auditing standards, the standards for financial audits contained in government auditing standards issued by the Comptroller General of the United States, and the Consolidated Audit Guide for Audits of HUD Programs. Now, I haven't read those, but how do we know that whether or not their decision not to go forward with the audit is not accommodated by these documents that are referenced?
Well, Your Honor, twofold. First.
Without having an expert testify about it.
Twofold, Your Honor. First, we're not saying that the audit was performed negligently. There is no audit that we can, there isn't an audit out there that we've seen that we can say, oh, you've made a mistake in that audit. It's negligence. You should have done X or Y or Z with this. Secondly, if the defendants have gotten into this and they believe, and when you look at the disengagement letter, they believe that the plaintiffs have not cooperated with or have withheld information from or have engaged in something that they didn't approve of.
It's more than that they didn't approve of it. What they're saying is we can't do what you wanted us to do under the agreement because of your actions. Now, they may or may not be right about that, but isn't that what they're saying? We can't do this audit, and we certainly can't do it by March 31st, 2008.
And that may be a defense of a prior breach of contract by the other party, the claiming party. It may be a defense of impossibility of performance. The difficulty here, though, is we haven't seen an answer. I feel like we're kind of speculating as to what those defenses are because they haven't been actually pled in the case. If I may, I think the thing that distinguishes this case from others is this. When you look at Martinez, when you look at Baumgartner, it talks about things that derive from a common law duty, from a statutory duty, fall under that category of negligence. And then we have this other line of cases that attempts to distinguish negligence from breach of contract. In those cases, McLister, Backstreet and others, and General Steel, those cases focus on specific terms in the contract, that the duties that were alleged to have been breached derive from what the parties bargained for. And if the statute has to have some guardrails on it, it can't just include everything. The General Assembly said causes of action that sound in negligence. So I think we need to look at this other line of cases. And the distinguishing difference is that other line of cases, all of those duties derive from what the parties bargained for, as opposed to what's implied by common law or what's implied by statutory duty. And I would ask
that all you would have to prove to establish your prima facie case and survive a motion for directed verdict is to prove that they entered the contract and did not perform by a certain date. Is that all you have to prove?
An argument would be, in order to survive the motion to dismiss that was brought here, is to demonstrate to the satisfaction of this court that this issue sounds in contract. That this is.
But in order to understand what the contract claim is, my question is, do you think all you have to prove at trial is that they entered the contract and didn't perform the audit by a date certain? Is that all you have to prove, or do you have to prove something about their professional standards?
Well, I think that's what we would have to prove in our case in chief. Now, I don't know what defenses they would bring. There may be defenses they would bring that would talk about why they thought they had a good reason for non-performance, but those would be resolved under contract principles. If I may, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
You may. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel? Is Mr. Farachi?
Farachi, Your Honor.
Farachi.
Your Honor, Paul Farachi, registration number 26032, appearing on behalf of the appellees. May it please the court. Before I start with the substantive issues, I did want to address the standard of review question, which had been raised in the briefs by the appellant. I think it's clear from numerous appellate cases that the correct standard of review in it, where the issue is whether the trial court correctly determined whether a certificate of review was required or not, is an abuse of discretion standard, not a heightened level of review. And in fact, Judge Nieto, you authored an opinion in Miller v. Rotech, R-O-W-T-E-C-H, which is at 3P3rd 492, Collar App 2000, articulating that exact conclusion. And that's also supported by the Jerome case, the Shelton case, and the Redden cases, which are all cited in our answer brief. So as a preliminary matter, the standard review is a very deferential abuse of discretion standard here.
Just before we leave that, would you also agree, though, that if the trial court somehow misinterpreted the law, that that could be an abuse of discretion, and whether they interpret he did misinterpret the law would itself be a legal question that we would review de novo?
I think it's kind of an unusual situation, because under 602 you have essentially what's a kind of a sui generis type proceeding. It's not a 12b5 motion. It's into the case law, it says it's really its own unique entity. So as to whether it's truly a question of law or whether it's more of a 104B type evidentiary ruling where the court has to analyze the entire context of it, there's no case law on that. It's my opinion that you can't resolve this in the abstract. You have to have some context, and the only way to do that is to have some information about the factual issues of the case. So I don't think it really is susceptible to de novo review for error of law issues, because it's an interpretation of the 602 statute in the context of the individual claims.
Counsel, what's your view, kind of following up on Judge Nieto's question of your opponent, what's your view of what their prima facie case must establish for the breach of contract claim?
I think that's an excellent question, Your Honor. And I think looking at the Deodosio case that they cited in their reply brief, as well as the D.R. Horton v. Bischoff, which is B-I-S-C-H-O-F, at 217 P3rd 1262, it's clear that the elements of the contractual claim are the existence of a valid binding contract first, which has its own components. But you have to also prove the defendant failed to perform under the contract, but also that the plaintiff substantially performed its obligations under the contract. That's an independent element for proof of breach of contract. And under the D.R. Horton case, they said that generally performance or substantial performance by the plaintiff is a condition precedent to the right to recover on the contract. So I think the contract claim itself builds in a requirement that the plaintiff have performed its obligations in order to claim that the defendant is liable for a breach of its obligations in the contract.
That require expert testimony?
In this case, I don't think there's any doubt it does, because if you go back to the contract, which again is at record pages 45 through 49, and Judge Loeb identified these issues in that document, there are myriad obligations for both parties. Starting on page 1, it's clear the accountants, as part of performing this audit, do have to adhere to a number of different, and I can tell you extraordinarily detailed, standards and guidelines in performing these. And they're listed as U.S. Generally Accepted Auditing Standards, the standards for financial audits contained in government auditing standards issued by the Comptroller General of the United States, and the Consolidated Audit Guide for audits of HUD programs. You're talking about extremely voluminous, thick standards.
Those establish obligations of the plaintiff?
Those are the defendant's obligations initially, but then if you flip to the next page, Your Honor, which is page 2, the management is articulated to have a number of different responsibilities as well. These are responsibilities that are described in these auditing standards. And the auditing, the requirements of management are also extremely complicated. It takes up the next 2.5 pages. Basically, it goes through talking about internal controls for the business. It talks about management representations in a letter to the auditors about certain aspects of the financial statements of other things. So I don't think there's any way a lay jury could potentially understand that without some guidance from an auditor or an accountant to say, this is what they have to do under these standards, this is what they have to do to comply. They did not do that here, or they did do it here if they're the plaintiff.
What's your view on whether the evidence to prove the breach of contract claim and the evidence to prove the negligence claim would be the same or different, and if different, how?
I think really the only substantive difference between the proofs of a professional negligence claim and the contract claim in this case are the substantial performance condition preceded by the plaintiff. In terms of the defendant's conduct, the proof is exactly the same. So if you look at the professional liability standard of care question for an accountant. The question is, did the accountants reasonably perform their obligations under the applicable standard of care for that profession? If you look at the contract provisions, they set forth the same exact accounting standards and audit standards that apply to how they were going to be performing this audit. And as you pointed out, Judge, one of the provisions is we may not be able to complete this audit for a number of different reasons, one of which would be the failure of management to perform its obligations in this situation. The Martinez case also says that each in a contract scenario, the parties have an implied obligation to perform their duties reasonably. That same reasonableness standard applicable to the audit standards that are described in the contract is the identical reasonableness standard that the duty of care applies in a negligence-based context. So I think it's pretty clear, Your Honors, that virtually identical proofs are going to be required for the negligence and the contract claim with respect to the defendant's conduct.
I take it an extension of your argument would be, as in connection with the issue that you have here, that those proofs would require for the jury to understand the case expert testimony.
Absolutely. I don't think there's any way around that.
Counsel, let me just ask you this, though. Top page 2, it says, if for any reason we are unable to form or have not formed an opinion, we may decline to express an opinion or to issue a report. It says if for any reason. Why do we need expert testimony then if it's for any, if the accountant has the right to just not do it on a whim?
Because I think, Your Honor, that the primary reasons are going to be the ones that are articulated in this contract and that are set forth in the obligations that they have in general as professionals in their duties to their clients. For example, failure of management to provide appropriate information, appropriate reassurances and representations, which if you look at page 50 of the record is exactly what happened here. There's a number of triggers to that provision. I don't think they're saying we can just quit any time and leave you high and dry. I think that would be a difficult argument.
But
I think
that's subject to restriction by the professional standards that you've alluded to.
Because it follows, if you note, Judge, it follows at the very end of that discussion of here are our obligations. And our obligations are governed by these different auditing standards and by our professional standards. And they say the next line is, if we can't complete this, we'll let you know. Or we may issue a report saying we can't complete this. So it's really based upon the professional standards, their ability to do what they need to do for the audits, the plaintiff's adherence to the management representations and other obligations of providing information, those kinds of things. So I think the question really for both the contract and the negligence claims are, is there, did they act reasonably in deciding not to complete this audit because of the problems with the professional standards and how the plaintiff was behaving? That is really at its core a negligence-based, duty-based question. It's a contract that gives rise to that for that claim, but it's really a professional negligence-based duty. And that, I think, is what many of the cases recognized and what the certificate of review statute recognizes, because it says it's not just does it sound in tort, it says are the claims based upon professional negligence. So the concept is, are the duties that we're talking about really at their core negligence, professional liability-based duties? I don't think there's any doubt here that for both you have to prove violation of the professional auditing standards, which are the structure that gives rise to the duties under either scenario. So in my opinion, judges, it's fairly clear that both these claims are based upon identical conduct, and the conduct is really the structure of the professional duties that my clients would owe to the plaintiff, and that's a negligence-based duty, even if it's incorporated into the contract claims by this document. So that's the first element of the question about whether the certificate of review is required for that claim. The second element is the necessity of expert testimony. I don't think I'm not sure there was any disagreement about that from plaintiff's counsel today, but I think it's fairly obvious based on the complexity of the standards, the complexity of the issues about how to evaluate did the management provide the appropriate information under the auditing standards? I mean, who's going to even explain the auditing standards to the jury other than an expert? There's no way to know what those are, what they mean, how to apply them to this case. So there's really no doubt that some kind of an expert is going to be required to establish either of these claims, both for the defendant's conduct, saying, did they behave appropriately and reasonably in following these standards and refusing to complete the audit, but also in the contract claim for the plaintiff's side of the case, which is, did they substantially perform their obligations to prove the breach of contract? So under the certificate of review, you have both of these claims are really based upon professional negligence. They both require expert testimony to establish the claims. And those are the two elements that invoke the certificate of review. So I don't think there's any doubt it really applies clearly here. There's been several cases describing that doesn't matter what you call the claims, you can try to end run the certificate of review statute by saying there's another kind of claim, even when there's contracts, and they've said that that does not avoid the certificate of review. Martinez addressed that. The Williams case where the plaintiff asserted fraudulent concealment, fraud, and defamation, and they said that was subject to the certificate of review. The even in the Baumgartner case, they said that all the claims were subject to the certificate of review because of the being based upon professional negligence, but they said that you didn't need expert testimony for a couple of them, so that they didn't fall under it for the purposes of the statute for that. But they said they were all based on professional negligence. And then the Taken v. Reynolds case, which said a CCPA claim was also subject to the certificate of review, even though obviously it's not theoretically a negligence. So because all of these fall under the certificate of review, they did not timely file a certificate of review. In fact, had a year and probably 2 months from the briefing to file a certificate and never did. The court's well within its discretion to have dismissed. Unless the court has any other questions, that's all I have.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Kelly?
Thank you, Your Honors. there's a nuance here that I think is getting lost in with counsel's argument, and that is the requirement of expert testimony. We have one line of cases that say if you fall into the negligence side of the spectrum, yes, you do that analysis about whether the case is so complex that a jury would have to hear expert testimony to understand it. Then you have this other line of cases that talks about if the court first determines that this falls into the contract column, there's no case law out there that says 602 requires expert testimony if this falls into the contract column.
Both those same cases say, even if you have a contract, or some of them say, even if you have a contract claim, if it's properly construed as just the same thing as a negligence claim, then you're right back in the first boat.
That is true, and there's cases out there that make exceptions to that. McLister, General Steel, talk about things, a specific contract provision. General Steel was, that contract identified a specific attorney who was to handle the case. McLister had a contract that promised a specific result, which is very similar to what we have here. That took it out of the negligence box and put it in, out of the negligence column and put it into the contract column under those two cases, and that's what I would be arguing applies here.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
And thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted, and we will render a decision in due course.